You're listening to Vatican Radio. On World Refugee Day this year, the international campaign to ban landmines called on states to eliminate the harrowing risks that refugees and asylum seekers face from landmines and other unexploded devices. Despite a 1997 treaty to ban the use of landmines, these indiscriminate weapons continue to injure and kill civilians every day in countries around the world. Over 150 states have signed and ratified the treaty, which prohibits the use, production, stockpiling and trade in anti-personnel mines. Yet an estimated 100 million of the deadly devices still lie in fields and along roads in former conflict zones, killing and maiming over 500 victims each week, earning them the nickname weapons of mass destruction in slow motion.
So women, refugees, farmers, children, these were the victims of war. These were the victims of landmines.
Jerry White lost his lower right leg in a landmine explosion, but went on to co-found a survivors network and then take a leadership role in the international campaign to ban landmines, which won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1997. Today he serves with the US State Department's Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations. Just recently, Jerry was in Rome and spoke to me about his work, his faith, and his own dramatic experience.
I was an Irish Catholic boy in the United States, and I grew up outside Boston. And then I studied Judaic studies and Jewish history at Brown University. In fact, I was the first Christian or the first non-Jew to graduate with a degree in Judaic studies. And it came time to go walk in the footsteps of the prophets, study Hebrew in the Holy Land. And I did that when I was 19 and ended up walking up in the throughout the land and in Egypt in the Sinai and really just enjoying the Bible landscapes. And suddenly, boom, it was a sunny day. I was camping with two friends and I step on a landmine. And it blows off my lower right leg. Quite a shock, as you might imagine. I had never even thought about minefields or knew they were a problem in the Middle East. So what happened is I ended up having to spend 6 months in a hospital in Israel learning to walk again. So it was quite a shock.
From that experience, you developed what is called the Landmine Survivors Network, didn't you? Tell us about that process. How was it that you transformed such a tragedy into such a positive experience?
Well, first of all, I had to get on with living, finish my studies, and move to Washington to start to look at international affairs with a particular interest in the Middle East. And it was in the 1990s where a new campaign started to emerge, the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. So I met another survivor by the name of Ken Rutherford. He had lost both his legs to a landmine in Somalia. He also was a civilian and not a soldier. And he said, Jerry, I was working on arms control at the time, non-proliferation. And he said, Jerry, you're tracking the wrong weapon of mass destruction. Landmines have killed more people than nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons combined. So with your personal experience losing a leg, your professional experience in arms control, why don't you help us with strategies to ban landmines around the world? So that was a moment where survivor to survivor, we started to network with other amputees all around the world, from Cambodia to Colombia to Afghanistan to Angola, and to look at how is it that one survives and how is it that we can collectively raise our voices as survivor advocates to ban this insidious weapon.
Certainly the Ban the Landmine campaign was one of the most successful international campaigns, wasn't it? What do you put that success down to?
I think it was a new day and age, not just with email, but sort of with cross-border communication, and also for civil society. In the 1990s, it was waking up not just to be an NGO here and an NGO there, but in fact connecting the dots. So like landmines, people hadn't paid attention because every 22 minutes someone was getting blown up. Individually, no one had seen that, in fact, the suffering was hundreds of thousands of people were being killed.
And 90% children.
Yeah, 90% were civilians. They weren't soldiers. So women, refugees, farmers, children, these were the victims of war. These were the victims of landmines. So I think that was the rightness of the cause, how to protect civilians from harm and war. It was the communications of the day, email connectivity. And also is the creativity and understanding that no problem could be solved by one NGO, you know, one country, that in fact you had to do cross-border work and work with governments and civil society. So this was a moment where I think civil society became a superpower in the world and started to hold governments and militaries accountable for military litter.
And that landmine campaign, the treaty, goes on to do extraordinary work, doesn't it? And yet, your own country, the United States, is not a signatory to that. Why is that?
I think it's important to understand that the great work of the campaign was recognized by the Nobel Prize. And our work, my particular work in my private capacity as a survivor, working with Princess Diana, raised global awareness of the issue. The United States, although it hasn't signed or ratified, is in fact the world's lead demining supporter around the world. It has done more to save lives and get mines out of the ground. About $120 million each year is spent towards these programs. It's larger than like all other countries combined. So the U.S. complies with the majority of actually this treaty, but up until now, because of issues related to the Korean Peninsula and other security concerns, the U.S. has not felt from a policy or political point of view that it was ready. The also good news is under this administration, under President Obama, there's been an instruction to review the landmine policy, including but not limited to the mine ban treaty. So this is a very current topic back in Washington under review. It would make me proud personally as a landmine survivor who was one of the architects of this campaign in the treaty, but also now working for the first time inside government to see this make progress. That would be a wonderful celebration, but we'll see.
You mentioned that visit with Princess Diana to Bosnia-Herzegovina. Describe that moment for us. It was as one of the most important moments, wasn't it, in making the world realize what was going on?
It sort of informed my view that if you do good work on right causes, sometimes the stars or the constellations align and you have a moment. So when Princess Diana got involved, first when she saw the devastation caused by landmines in Angola in January 1997, her first visit to a minefield, the cameras of the world focused attention on her and where she went. So by walking into that sort of those iconic photographs of walking along minefields and holding survivors and children, the world paid attention. So that was an enzyme and a catalyst that really did immediate public awareness. I mean, it was like electricity. What was wonderful, too, that doesn't happen accidentally. It happens when someone is truly compassionate and a humanitarian. Diana was an authentic champion for the cause. So in working with me very closely in the last year of her life, we directed attention to the suffering of people. You know, what was happening? What was the real effect of this weapon? That this was not a technology story or a military story. This was a human story. And what is it about landmines? How do they cause the devastation? How does it prevent farming? So really, she put a human face on it and almost single-handedly, with that chemical in the room, translated it from a security issue to a humanitarian one. That was very important for the narrative and for public awareness.
Celebrities, famous faces, we've seen time and time again the effect they can have. What do you think is the role of the church, of religious leaders, in this particular campaign against landmines?
It's a great question. I mean, in Diana's case, as a celebrity, I would get to emotional and compassionate authority. She was a highly empathetic woman who championed empathy and healing and compassion and humanitarian work. Like I said, it was authentic. When that happens, people follow leaders and get engaged. When it comes to the Catholic Church, when it comes to Islamic leaders, when it comes to rabbis or spokespersons, you need authenticity. And the role of religious leaders is one of moral authority. They have followers. They have constituents. They can influence, whether it be through citing things from the Bible about compassion and protecting of civilians or the Quran or the Torah. It doesn't really matter. It's about the community that is values-driven and values-based. So religious leadership and engagement is critical for all of the big issues of our day, at least because 85% of the world are actually meaning-seeking creatures, people who are living out their faith and rather devoted. So in fact, if you don't have an engagement strategy that deals with faith-based communities, I don't see how you succeed.
Can I ask you the role of your own faith, if you continue to see that as an important part of the work you do?
I think it's interesting to me that my impulse, as I described earlier, was to walk in the footsteps of the prophets. My source of inspiration is faith. I'm inspired by biblical leaders. I'm inspired by Christ. I'm inspired by my own religious upbringing. So that is a well which one draws on. And to sustain very difficult work in the face of genocide, landmines, conflict, you know, my life's work has been in this space of helping to alleviate the suffering inflicted by man's inhumanity, violence, that to sustain that work, one needs to draw from a well, from a source. So for me personally, that has been helpful to sort of go the distance on these issues. Also, I think sometimes the world becomes very negative. It can't be done. It won't be done. It shouldn't have you looked at these conflicts are intractable, including, you know, the Middle East, current negotiations over Israel-Palestinian two-state solutions. Everyone can be, all the smart people around the world can be cynical and realpolitik. But you have to still believe in miracles. Something happens. A Diana shows up. The stars align. So whatever your vocabulary is for that, mine is, you know, sourced from faith. But I'm quite clear on my professional job to sort of keep that hat as a personal motivation, not necessarily a professional one. So I would think faith is intrinsic. I see that those people who have been some of the most transformative leaders in the world, from Gandhi to Martin Luther King to Mandela, if you scratch the surface and look at what they're where they're drawing, you're going to see a spiritual story, people who learn to breathe and pray. And in fact, that's one of the secrets I find. I guess I'd add one other thing, maybe it may sound a little more secular, but in looking at survivors around the world, one of the ingredients for resilience was what I would call hope, or the ability to choose life, this idea that you are not going to be defined by your worst possible painful moment, and that you actually believe that perhaps you're more than your body, that therefore you can go on making meaning out of tragedy, making the cliche of lemonade out of lemons, requires a story. Reading into something and deciding that I'm going to make something of this. I will transform. I will make a miracle out of this awful tragedy or incident. It's a choice. And we found with most survivors we interviewed who were the most resilient, they were making those choices. And many of them, it was because of a faith or an aha moment that was spiritual.
My thanks there to Jerry White, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy, Partnership and Learning with the US State Department's Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations.